But I'm thankful to be with you. I'm thankful, too, to be able to study a set of Psalms that quite often people do not understand. And quite frankly, that people just neglect. Because they think, well, that's not good. The sentiments expressed there are not good. But I'm persuaded we really haven't understood some of these things. And that's what I'm going to attempt to deal with in our study this morning. I'm going to raise a question this morning, but I think I'll raise it after we've read a passage. Let's turn to the 139th Psalm. Psalm 137. We better get off on the right foot here. Psalm 137. From the opening sentence, you can understand that the psalmist here is talking about the experience of the Israelites during their exile, during the time of captivity over in Babylon. They were there for punishment. That's exactly why they were there. The Lord had taken them to the woodshed over in Babylon. It was because of their wickedness, their unrepentant sin, that the Lord had punished them. And from that kind of situation, the psalmist says, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept, when we remembered Zion. We hung our harps upon the willows in the midst of it. For there those who carried us away captive ask of us a song, and those who plundered us requested mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. Now just think about that. Here they were being almost commanded, as it were, by their captors, sing for us. But how do you sing the Lord's song under those circumstances? That's the point of the next verse. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? Here they were separated from their land, separated from the scenes that they held dear, separated from the temple worship and the other actions of the law of Moses, mandated by the law that is connected with worship. Actions which they once had gone through maybe just in a perfunctory way, that is thinking that we'll just do it because it's our duty. They had not put their hearts in it because their hearts really were not attached or connected to God. But here they are separated from those familiar scenes. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. If I do not remember you, let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. Remember, O Lord, against the sons of Edom, the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it, to its very foundation. O daughter of Babylon, who are to be destroyed, happy the one who repays you as you have served us. Happy the one who takes and dashes your little ones against the rock. These last few verses, especially 7, 8, and 9, are the verses that draw our attention this morning. Why would the psalmists here ask the Lord to remember something against the sons of Edom? To remember what he here calls the day of Jerusalem. You see, the day of Jerusalem was the day when Jerusalem was destroyed. The day when Jerusalem was abandoned. And the sons of Edom had a part in it. Now, who were the Edomites? They were just cousins, you might say, of the Israelites. The Israelites descended from Israel, or Jacob as his name first was. The Edomites, or the sons of Edom, had descended from Esau. Jacob and Esau were brothers, so their descendants were cousins. So these were national cousins, you might call them. But here they were asking the Lord of heaven and earth to remember the day when the Edomites had participated in Israel's downfall, Judah's downfall, really, the southern kingdom. To remember that against them. Now the Edomites on that occasion had said, raise it, that is, level it. Destroy it. They were calling for the destruction of the city of Jerusalem down to its very foundation, as the verse says. It was their wickedness that prompted them thus to act and thus to speak. But why would the sons of Israel cry out for the Lord to remember this against the sons of Edom? And why would they add to that in verses 8 and 9, Babylon? O daughter of Babylon, who are to be destroyed? Why? Well, Babylon was also involved in that captivity, you see. It was the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar who had come destroying the temple, destroying the city, and taking away the captives to the land. Not only had they done it that time, but they'd come and taken captives on two earlier occasions. On one of those earlier occasions, Daniel had been taken into captivity. On another of those earlier occasions, Ezekiel was taken. And now, for the third time, they come and just make havoc of the whole place. Destroy it. They were not alone, though. The Edomites were involved, as we said from that earlier verse. So why would the psalmist here say, happy the one who repays you, or blessed is the one who repays you, and blessed the one who takes and dashes your little ones against the rock? I'm going to ask a question which may well stagger the minds of some people, maybe not yours, but the minds of some people elsewhere who've not studied the Bible and who don't believe the Bible. Did God sin in the imprecatory Psalms? After all, God acted in response to this appeal from the psalmist. Why did God allow such a sentiment to be expressed in the book of Psalms? Did God sin? Well, obviously not. If you believe what the Bible teaches, then you believe that God is righteous, that God is light. In Him there is no darkness at all. You believe that. And so to ask a question like this to you is quite silly, really. But I ask it because it deals with the very issue that some have raised concerning the imprecatory Psalms. The imprecatory Psalms are Psalms of cursing. Psalms, that is, in which the psalmist asks God to destroy, to carry out His curse against certain nations, certain cities, certain peoples. That's what an imprecatory psalm is. And some have said, oh, this is so unlike the loving and merciful God I believe in, or that I read about in the Bible. Yes. If that's all you read about God, and if that's all you believe about God, then it may be true that this is not the picture of God you've conjured up in your minds. But remember, it's a picture that you've pictured or conjured up on the basis of partial revelation, not the complete picture. That's the way people approach the study of the Bible. That's the way people approach their religious practice, cafeteria style. They pass down the cafeteria line or the buffet line. Oh, that looks so good. I want some. I want that fried chicken. I want that chocolate pie, that potato salad. But these green peas, I don't want them. Or the salad fixings back here, the children say, don't want that. That's the way we do. We as a human family, that is. We pass down the cafeteria line. We take some of this, some of this, some of that, but the rest we reject. And it's that way with Bible study and religious practice. Or not. People do what they want to do. They believe what they want to believe. And then say, that's not the God I believe in. That's true. Because they don't believe in the God of the Bible. They've not reached their conclusions concerning God from what the Bible gives as the complete picture of God. So that's true. Some have said that the Bible and God even violate their own moral standards in such passages as these. That's because they don't understand. First of all, what is being called for or the nature of the action that's being taken to punish the wicked, nor do they understand the opportunity for repentance that God has always allowed before He took His action of punishment, judgment, or condemnation. They don't understand that. They don't get the whole picture. Even Thomas Paine, in his book Age of Reason, back in the very early years of this country's existence, Paine, of course, was a skeptic. And Paine wrote in his book, said that the Bible brutalizes and corrupts. And in fact, he said that more than half of the Bible is filled with language. That's not true. Not nearly true. Not nearly, nearly true. That's what he said. And because he said it, people who had something against the Bible believed what Paine said instead of going to the Bible and searching in it. So we need to remember, human beings in general have often tried to made God in their own image. Isn't that what Paul said the pagans had done in Romans 1? They had rejected the truth of God for a lie. You know what that means? The truth of God's existence, the truth of God's character, the truth of God's work, they've rejected all of that for the lie of idolatry. They've created God. They've made Him even like human beings. They look like that. You know, that's really the only way we could make God look the way something we've seen. But that's what the pagans had done. But that's the essence of idolatry. The essence of idolatry is making our gods the way we want them to be. And then falling down before them and worshiping them. But in reality, when we worship gods that we conceive and gods that we have fashioned or tailored, we're really worshiping ourselves, aren't we? That's exactly the way it is. They had exchanged the truth of God for a lie. Well, let's think about this. What are these imprecatory psalms? They're just psalms that curse the enemy, that called for God to curse him, that he is to bring about punishment. And some have said that these psalms contain hostile emotions. That's not true, I'm persuaded. I'm persuaded that the emotions that are expressed there come from the zeal, the faith-begotten zeal of the psalmist as he asks God to carry out God's work. To do God's work. Not man's, but God's work. That's what happens in these. This might seem vindictive or vengeful to human beings. They might think, oh, David or whatever psalmist it was in that particular psalm is just wanting to get back at these people because of some personal vendetta. Not so. It's because God, His cause, His people have been wrong. That's the point of it all, I fully believe. Some have even said that when the horrible suffering in the last verse of this Psalm 137, calling for the death of children, little ones, some have even said that this is uncivilized. And we're going to deal with that in just a minute. Charged that a lower level of divine revelation or inspiration is involved when you get into passages like this. These are not fully inspired. That these passages arise from the hearts of the writers, even though their hearts were amiss at times, but they express the hearts of the writers, and they're just recorded by inspiration. Now, I think that sometimes inspiration does record the wicked deeds, the wicked thoughts, and the wicked feelings of people. I think that's so. But in these cases, I don't really think that's what has happened. In these cases, it's my understanding that the psalmist is simply expressing to God his petition, his appeal to God, that God might carry out what God has promised to do. And I'll get to that in just a few minutes. So it does not represent a lower level of divine revelation or of a lower level of divine inspiration. I said a while ago that I believe inspiration can sometimes record things that are not true. For example, the book of Job. When Job's friends came, the different things they said to him, they didn't speak the truth. They missed it by a country mile, as we say sometimes. They didn't identify the real problem in what they said, but inspiration recorded it accurately. They were not moved, they were not inspired by God to speak as they spoke, not those enemies. But inspiration did record those things. However, in this case, I do believe that it's different. What is the pattern generally followed in these imprecatory psalms, these psalms of cursing? Well, generally, the psalmist first of all asks God to punish the enemy. Now, that might be done more than once, but usually it comes fairly close to the beginning of the psalm, or at least to the beginning of that section of the psalm that is imprecatory. In the 137th, the whole psalm is not imprecatory, just the last part. But that'll come somewhere close to the beginning of that section or that psalm. In the second place, he'll explain why the enemy is guilty. He's already done that here, of course. He gives the reason for the punishment that he's asking God to bring against them. And then in the third place, and I corrected that word again on my little drive, but Heath already had it. I sent it to him by email. So I know how to spell A-G, let's see, is it S-A-I-N? No, A-G-A-I-N, the word again. But he might often again call for punishment. All right, so that's the general pattern that these imprecatory psalms follow. Now, why do they present a problem? I've already suggested to you that a lot of people in the world think they see a problem. Some people say, well, God is violating His own standards. Or His people are violating the Bible standards. The Bible is violating its own standards. And that's basically it. They claim that a character unlike God's character is the one that's being depicted. But they don't understand some things. We'll get to that in just a minute. This has caused some to deny the inspiration of the Bible, by the way. They say, I don't believe that the Bible is inspired by God. About 3 years ago, one of the professors at Athens State University, by the name of Mark Durm, D-U-R-M, was writing a series of articles for which the newspaper there in Athens gave him free space. And he was attacking a number of ideas that people generally hold to. Most of them were not religious ideas, but finally he got into that area. He was paving the way, I guess. He got into that area and he attacked the God of the Bible on this very ground. On this very ground. Now, he didn't use the 137th Psalm. He used an instance in which God brought about the punishment against the Midianites, as I recall. That's what he did. But he took the typical approach. He said, this is not the God of the New Testament. He said, this is not the God that I believe in. I believe in the God of the New Testament, the God who's loving and gracious and merciful and forgiving. Well, I do too. But I also believe in a God who punishes people who do not repent when they're given time or space to repent. I believe that. He doesn't. Obviously, he doesn't. Well, I contacted the newspaper and I asked them for equal space. They were giving him his space every time he wrote a column. It wasn't every week, but it was almost every week. They wouldn't give me the space. They said all I could do is write a letter to the editor. And, of course, I was very limited in the space that I had. And you better believe that I did some editing and shortening. I wanted to say just what I wanted to say. I wanted everything in it that I could get in it. But I wanted it to have some punch. But more than that, of course, I wanted it to accurately represent what the Bible does teach. And I dealt with all of these issues very briefly in that letter to the editor. Because I didn't want some people turning against the Bible because of some uninformed college professor. I didn't want that to happen. But you know, the Psalms are no more imprecatory than the prophets are. And if you don't believe me, just turn over to Hosea chapter 13, verse 16. I'm just going to look at Hosea. I put Isaiah up here too. Others could be cited. Frequently, the prophets talk about God's punishing the enemy, the adversary. But in Hosea 13 at verse 16, the Bible tells us that the psalmist, the prophet rather, Hosea, is saying, Samaria is held guilty, for she has rebelled against her God. They shall fall by the sword, their infants shall be dashed in pieces, and their women with child ripped open. The prophet Hosea here is depicting what's going to happen during the time of battle. It's warfare. It's battle. And it's warfare which God Himself has prompted or promoted. And so, while it might not be a pleasant picture to think about, the book of Psalms is not the only book in the Bible where such appears. You know, if you indict one of them, you indict the other. That is, if you indict the Psalms, you also indict the prophets. But I'm going to even broaden it beyond that and say, if you indict the Old Testament, you also indict the New Testament. Because, believe it or not, the New Testament includes imprecatory sections. And I'm going to prove that to you before we stop this morning. So if you indict part of the Bible, you must indict all of it in fairness. And really, you're doing it on the basis of a human standard. A standard that is, that you think is applicable, which doesn't take a lot of things into account. Well, you can find imprecatory psalms. Some have said that there are as many as 118. I don't believe that. Some have said as few as 3. I don't believe that either. I believe there are more. I would mention the 35th. The 55th, the 59th, the 69th, the 79th, the 109th, and the 137th. I would mention all of those and many other short sections of various songs. But let's remember that. This is why they present a problem. Now, how can we explain God speaking and acting in the way that He does in the imprecatory Psalms? And by the way, what time should I plan to stop? About 11? At least by 11? Okay. I thought probably so. How can we explain this? Well, I want you to turn to Genesis chapter 12. Genesis chapter 12, verses 2 and 3. Back in that chapter, God was beginning making his promises to Abraham. You're familiar with Abraham, a great man who believed God. Left Ur of the Chaldees, came to Haran, up at the head of the Fertile Crescent, and then eventually moved southwest into the land of Canaan. And there God said, this land is going to belong to your people. I'm going to give it to them. It's the land of promise, the land of Canaan. But I want you to notice the basis upon which God was going to proceed in His dealings with Abraham and that nation growing out of his loins. The basis upon which He would proceed is found in verses 2 and 3. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now the question arises, what is God talking about here? God is giving what I call His national defense policy for Israel in verse 3. That's what it amounts to. His national defense policy. Our country has a national defense policy. I hope it does. I'm not sure, though, in view of some things and some people that are presently involved. But God said in the case of Israel, I'll bless those who bless you. I'll curse the one who curses you. God saying, I'm going to be your shield, your defender. God saying, I'm going to protect your nation. That's what He's saying here. And so that's the national security for Israel, or the national defense. Well, it occurs to me that in the book of Psalms, as well as in that incident involving God's destroying the Midianites, and in His statements of the same kind through the prophets, in all of those, as well as in New Testament sections that involve curses or imprecations, in all of those, God's essential will is involved. God is just carrying out His will to punish the evildoer, even the wicked nation, and to protect the doer of right, or the good nation. Isn't that His will even for government today, according to Romans 13? To punish the evildoer, and to protect the law-abiding citizen, the one who does what is right. And the civil servant is even designated by the Lord there in Romans 13 as being His servant, His minister. But furthermore, He says, an avenger of wrath. You remember that statement in Romans 13? That's not the civil servant's wrath. It's not the wrath of the people. It's God's wrath. The civil servant has been designated by God to avenge His wrath. And His is a judicial wrath. A wrath that is settled and founded upon the principles of right. He doesn't have temper tantrums like men do. It's not that kind of wrath. It's His settled judicial wrath, which is often expressed, but also often reserved or contained until people have had time to repent. That's the picture that the Bible gives us. And so that's why the psalmists and the prophets often ask God to act, to destroy the nation, even to destroy the children. Why? They're asking God to keep His promise. The promise that He made back there to Abraham. Now, God's going to keep His promise. You can depend on that. And I want to suggest something right here at this little earlier time than I meant to mention this. But I personally do not believe that there's any more sin involved in our asking God to carry out His promise than there is in God carrying out His promise. If it's right for Him to carry it out, then it's right also for us to pray or to ask Him to carry it out. They're both right or both wrong. There's no way you can have it that God is right to do it, but we're wrong to ask Him to do it. Now, I'll put some modifications on that, some limitations on that in a few minutes as well. Because He is our defender and our shield. After all, God is the superintendent of the nations. He's created all nations of men to dwell on the whole face of the earth and has appointed beforehand their pre-appointed times or seasons and the boundaries of their habitations. Remember that statement in Paul's sermon to the Athenians in Acts 17? He's saying there that God is the one who sets the time boundaries and the place boundaries. God's the one who's in charge. God's the one who has oversight or superintendence of the nations. And the familiar passages from the book of Daniel that talk about God setting up those whom He will. And then the explanation of the dream or the vision in Daniel 5, the one concerning Belshazzar, that simply is a playing out of God's national defense policy. The Babylonians had come in not because they thought they were carrying out God's will. The Babylonians didn't attack Judah to please God or to help God. God was using them, though. They were doing it out of their own selfish interest. They were attacking to get things, to get money, to get people, slaves that they could put into forced service. That's why Babylon did it, for wicked purposes. And so in the dream, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin, God had the right to set the boundaries. Let's look at that in Daniel chapter 5, just very briefly this morning. Daniel 5, beginning at about verse 26. This is the interpretation of each word. Verse 26. Mene. God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Does God have the right to do that? You better believe He does. God is the superintendent of the nations. Like Paul announced in Acts 17. And here's a nation which has attacked His own people. God's taking care of them. He's carrying out His national defense policy. He's numbered your kingdom and finished it. Verse 27, Tekel. You have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. So they were not what they should have been. They didn't measure up to God's standard for them. Peres, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. A divided and weakened kingdom. Yes. Think about that. God is simply carrying out His promises. In Deuteronomy 28, I'll not get into much this morning, verse 49 beginning especially. There in the midst of those blessings, And then curses that God announced primarily for His people in that section. He said in verse 49, if you don't obey me, if you don't stay in covenant relationship to me, I'll bring a nation from afar. You remember that? A distant nation. I'll bring them in and they will humble you. They will punish you. God did that. What, three different times? He did it with the Assyrians for the northern kingdom. He did it with the Babylonians for the southern kingdom. He did it with Rome to finish the kingdom finally over in AD 70. Three different times God brought that nation from afar. And yet those proud Pharisees in the book of John said, wow, we're Abraham's seed. We've never been in bondage to anybody. It wasn't so, was it? Why did God do that? It's because of the statement that He announces in Proverbs 14 and that He deals with elsewhere. It's because righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. That's why God would protect His people. And any people, for that matter, who are seeking to serve Him, seeking to do His will. Now, I'm not saying that the other nations are on the same level with Israel. They weren't. Nor are we today. But there's still a standard of righteousness that God expects out of any people, even today. He'll punish those who don't subscribe to it, don't follow it. And He'll take care of or punish those, or protect, I should say, those who do. Now, about the children. May I suggest to you that this is not simply a picture of child or infant brutality. This is a picture of what happened in warfare, and it happens even today to some extent. It's just a natural part of the process of warfare. But look at it from the better standpoint. Look at it from the better perspective. When the children of wicked people have their lives snuffed out early in life, is that not a blessing to them? The entire nation is going to be destroyed. The children will not be brought up under those circumstances or in that situation of sinful environment. And thus future problems are eliminated. And the evil future that usually would be the potential of those children is eliminated. Wouldn't you rather have a child that could go immediately to be with the Lord because of innocence than one that lived on in that same sinful environment and began to participate in it, partake of it? And thus was destroyed because of sin. I think we can understand the advantage of that. But we also must appreciate the divine patience, the long-suffering of God, which was involved with His own people and with other people. If you want to read a passage or read a book that emphasizes repeatedly how long-suffering God was, study the book of Hosea. 6 or 7 years ago, when I was going through the book again, my commentary on the book of Hosea, I was impressed with those different oracles, those different inspired messages, chapter 3 down through the end of the book. Every one of them is a separate sermon, you might say, a separate message, delivered evidently at a separate, different time, under maybe a little bit different circumstances. And in some of those messages, the Lord is appealing to them to do what's right. In others, the Lord is warning them against what's facing them if they don't do what's right. You see, it becomes pretty clear by studying those different messages that were delivered at different times that God, yes, was long-suffering. And He was long-suffering repeatedly, not just one time, but repeatedly. And so he is today. But we also can exhaust his patience. And we need to be careful about that. We need to realize the divine patience of God was intended to avert his wrath. And thus he raised up his servants, the prophets, early. As one of the statements says, that is, in plenty of time. To warn the people, to turn them away from their sinfulness. God did not send punishment immediately. It was not inevitable. It could be avoided by their repentance. And that's why he used the prophets. That's why he sent prophets even to Gentile nations. What about Jonah? He went up to Nineveh. That was a Gentile city in Assyria. What about Nahum? Edom. And then in Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, there are lengthy sections dealing with the different nations, the different pagan cities, where the prophet would cry out against them. Don't ever think that God didn't warn them. He did. He did. That's what Daniel was doing. He was over in the land of Babylon when he was doing his work. Daniel was speaking to the heads of government, the officials. Ezekiel was out in the country among the public, among the masses. They both were warning a wicked people of what would happen if they didn't turn from their wickedness. Even there, there was divine patience, or the long-suffering of God. Now, God used the same principle in his dealing with nations that he imposed upon Israel through their law, the law of Moses, and that's Lex Talionis. We sometimes call it an eye for an eye, and sometimes people hear that and they say, "Ah, you've cut my leg off, and so I'm going to cut yours off." Well, it's not a matter of revenge. That's not why it was imposed. It was imposed to put the brakes on and to keep people from going too far. You couldn't make the punishment worse than the crime. The punishment needed to fit the crime. And so if an eye was put out, the greatest punishment that could be imposed was the eye of the other person, the eye of the offender. But it was used on individual dealings in the law. But it's also used with the nations God is dealing with. He often speaks of it. He speaks of it as balancing the scale sometimes. And that's what it means. He's going to be just. He's going to be equitable. It's not personal retaliation. That's something we need to emphasize. Not even here in this 137th Psalm, where the psalmist is asking God to do his work, not even there is personal revenge or personal retaliation involved. After all, the act of the Edomites and the act of the Babylonians was not directed against individuals like the psalmist. It was directed against all the people, the nation. And when the psalmist cries to God to keep his promise, to maintain his national defense policy that we've already talked about, it's not national retaliation that he's calling for. And by the way, there is no difference in the Old Testament standard along that line and the New Testament standard. Even in the Old Testament, the Lord made it very clear that personal revenge was wrong. Even back in the Old Testament, the Lord said, you're to love your enemy. I want us to be aware of that. In Leviticus chapter 19, at verse 18, the Lord had something to say along that line. Leviticus 19, verse 18. Notice. You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Somebody says, the old law allowed hate your enemy. No, it didn't. It said, love your enemy. We misrepresent the Bible. when we say that about it. I've heard even brethren say years ago that that's the difference between the Old and New Testaments. That in the Old Testament, the Lord said, love your brother, but you can hate your enemy. And the New Testament, he said, love both. No, he didn't. That's not a fair representation of what the Bible says. And I have some other passages here that I'm not going to read this morning, but I would call them to your attention here on the second page of the outline. Proverbs 24:17 and 25, verses 21 and 22. I am going to emphasize that this same kind of thing occurs in the New Testament. Over in 1 Timothy chapter 4, 2 Timothy chapter 4, at verse 14. Alexander the coppersmith did me much harm. Now what did Paul say next? May the Lord repay him according to his works. That's an imprecatory statement. That's a request to the Lord, a prayer to God, that he would carry out his will. A man who evidently had not repented of the harm that he sought to do to the Apostle Paul. Over in the book of Galatians, chapter 5, at verse 12, there's something similar. Galatians 5, verse 12. Paul said, I could wish that those who trouble you would even cut themselves off, mutilate themselves, is the idea. And he uses that expression because of what they're insisting upon, the act of circumcision. A fleshly act. Paul says, I could wish that they would mutilate themselves. And then in Revelation chapter 6, at verse 10, there is the New Testament's commendation of this very kind of prayer. Here, of course, in the 6th chapter, what we have down in verse 10 is really a prayer to God or a conversation with God. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? The enemies, the adversaries, the persecuting element are the ones in view there. And so we need to appreciate the fact that the New Testament is no different from the Old in that respect. It also contains some of these imprecatory sections. Now, should a Christian pray for his enemy's downfall? That's a question that I'm going to raise just briefly here at the end. In other words, can we do what they did? Can we do it? It's never right to engage in personal revenge. We can't do it if we're asking God to do it out of a spirit of personal revenge. That would be wrong. That would be praying amiss. Praying from the wrong motive. We can't do that. James teaches us that in the book of James. But rather we must give place to wrath. That is, to God's wrath. That's what the Roman letter urges, isn't it? In Romans 12. Don't avenge yourselves, but give place to God's wrath, the wrath of God. Why? He has the right to do this. He has the right to execute wrath upon the soul of every person that does evil. And he can do it without having a temper tantrum or without the spirit of revenge, personal revenge being involved. We don't have the right to do that. We might not have the ability to carry it out in that way. When we personally are involved, that is. But we give place to God's wrath. Now, I'll make this statement. If it is possible for you to pray like this to God without personal animosity toward your enemy, then I believe it is scriptural. I believe it is right to pray to God to execute his wrath. Can you do that as far as nations are concerned? I suspect you can. Can you do that as far as individuals are concerned? Probably so in a lot of cases. But the closer it gets to us, the more careful we have to be, of course, that we don't act or we don't pray from the wrong spirit or from the wrong motive. What I'm saying to you is that when we do what God shows us was right to do, right for Him to do in the first place and right for others to do in the second place, when we do that, we're not doing wrong if we do it from the right motive, if we do it with the right spirit. And those who say, oh, this is not like God. This is not the God that I believe in. Really what they're doing is trying to appear more righteous than God. They somehow have conceived the idea that it's righteous not to punish the wicked. And I think I know why. I think it's because man's concept of what is wicked has fallen so far. We tolerate just anything. Maybe a child murderer, a murderer of children, maybe put him to death. But if it's not that bad, a lot of people don't tolerate. So it's possible to appear more righteous than God. I'm reminded of a statement made in the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 3, verse 8. God said, there is a time to love and a time to hate. Now, does he mean we ought to hate people? No. But you can hate kinds of people. The way people act, in other words, the way they behave, the way they do, you can hate that. There's a time to love and a time to hate. In conclusion, then, I'm going to tell you, God did not sin in the imprecatory Psalms. Let us guard our hearts, because malice, ill will, is never right. But if we can act and pray apart from malice in this area, then we can pray and appeal to God just as the psalmist did. We need to love our enemies, do what is for His good at all times, and let God do His job. Exert His control over the nations as well as His control of individuals, which of course He'll ultimately exercise in the final. But it is not wrong, I believe, to ask God to do His will or to ask Him to do such things as we've been talking about this morning.